Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In her new novel, The Mighty Red, Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award-winning author Louise Erdrich tells a story of love, natural forces, spiritual yearnings, and the tragic impact of uncontrollable circumstances on ordinary people's lives. Time is the driving pulse of the novel, set in the Red River Valley of North Dakota. Human time, deep time, Red River time, the half-life of herbicides and pesticides, and the elegance of time represented in fracking core samples from unimaginable depths are set against the speed of climate change, the depletion of natural resources, and the sudden economic meltdown of 2008 to 2009. Louise Erdrich is the author of many novels as well as volumes of poetry, children's books, and a memoir. Her novel, The Night Watchman, won the Pulitzer. The Roundhouse won the National Book Award. Her last novel was The Sentence. Her new novel is The Mighty Red. And it's always a pleasure to welcome Louise Erdrich to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. And hi, everybody who's tuned in.
It's wonderful to have you. And I thank you so much. The last time you were on was for The Sentence. And I'm curious as to what that time has been like. That was a book that was very well received. And then how you move on to the next project.
I usually start a book while I'm finishing the book I'm working on. It allows me to make a transition. That's what happens. I have trouble letting go of a book. I have trouble letting go of my characters. I have trouble finishing a book. No trouble starting a book. But I really kind of hate to finish a book. So it's good for me to have another book on the way so that I can turn my attention to that one. And that's how this happened. I was thinking of this book, oh my gosh, maybe 10 years ago, maybe more. I didn't know what the book would be, but I had characters who were in the beginning of, who were at the first meeting of the farmers who eventually got together to grow sugar beets throughout the Red River Valley. Mm-hmm. I had characters who were in the oil fields in North Dakota. I had characters who were small town bookstore, and I didn't know how they would come together, but finally they did, and they began to tell me that this was the time to write this book.
So let's talk a little bit about the setting, which is rural North Dakota, Red River Valley, and this is not far from the Canadian border.
It could be anywhere up and down the Red River, actually. But it's at one of the places where there is a sugar factory. So there are several places along the Red River where there is industrial beet farming, but also the factory for the sugar is also located in central places central to those fields. So it's a good thing in some ways, because most everything that is made or mined or fracked or what have you in North Dakota or grown, especially grown, is exported, and you don't really see so much profit coming into people there. So this is this means that there are jobs, and you know, it's a different thing than it used to be when I was much younger and hoed sugar beets as my first job. So yes, it's set in an entire system of farming and getting the beets to the factories, and who are the people who do this, who are the people who are there at every step of the way.
And these are farms that are having trouble. The banks are failing. It's a tough time in that environment.
Well, it's a tough time, but I don't think you're seeing the kind of farm failure that you did in the 80s, where there was a direct response to having the Farm Home and Administration loans called in under the Reagan administration meant that farms were failing right and left, smaller farms especially. This isn't the same thing. It's a different sort of economic crisis. It's set in 2008, 2009.
Right.
And this is a large enough operation, so it's not going to get hit in the same way. But, you know, we're talking about all around about the whole setting, but I just want to say this setting is where we get to talk about all sorts of things that happen, like a teenage love triangle, a wedding that goes awry, a proposal. Everything goes awry within this wedding situation. The proposal is endlessly going awry, finally works out. And then, I don't want to give away too much, but there a calamity occurs the night before the wedding.
Right.
And the bride, who is really not sure this should be happening, then feels absolutely compelled to get married.
Tell us about the characters. Right in the center of this is Kismet, which is just an amazing name, but an amazing character as well. Tell us about Kismet.
Well, I'm glad you say that about her name, because I'm sort of hoping we'll see children named Kismet. Why not? Anyway,
start the trend.
I don't meet many or anybody so far named Kismet, except for, well, there's a whole other story with that.
That's an amazing name for a character who is very special.
She is. And her mother named her this because she wanted her child to have some sort of some better luck than they've had. She wanted her child to have a kind of introduction to the world that included, I suppose, a favored by fortune name.
Having that has what impact do you think on Kismet's life?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because her mother raises her somewhat in the way she came to live her life, which is to be thrifty, thoughtful, always on the mark with a job, with, you know, taking care of her house, trying to make a good life for her daughter. So she's raising her daughter this way, but also she is doing this thing that Kismet's name suggests. She's letting her daughter knows she's favored by fortune. And so her daughter takes some chances with her life that maybe she wouldn't if she didn't think that she was under some sort of lucky star. But she marries a fellow who has a guardian angel. I'm saying this because we find that out in the beginning. And because of all of his lucky escapes in life, we really have to believe there's something of this nature about him as well.
My question is, first, does he have a guardian angel? And second, how to say thank you specifically to an angel? Oh, and third, how do we stop these things from happening? This is from the very beginning of the novel.
Yeah.
And it's a neat idea of having a guardian angel, and in the sense of how it is thought about in this book, that if angels exist and they are our guardians.
Well, I grew up in a church school, a Catholic church school, in which I was assured that I personally had a guardian angel. So those were the questions I had. Those were the questions I wanted to know. Who was this guardian angel? Was I really being looked after by this guardian angel? You know, I had one of these pictures that a lot of kids, now it's kind of a kitschy picture, but it used to be what everyone had. It was a picture of two children, I think, crossing a bridge with an angel sort of hovering behind them with the legs, the wings kind of stretched out. And, you know, it's so tempting and wonderful to believe that we have that. But in some ways, we have to believe that. Or how could we go about things? But of course, it's also a suspension of disbelief to believe that. And what we find out in life is that some things go right, some things go wrong.
Mm.
And we're just very fortunate if more things go right than go wrong, right? So as time goes on, you realize that you may have a guardian angel at some points, but maybe they aren't looking all the time. And I don't know how to really explain it because I have to dip back into childhood to really understand why I wrote angels into this book.
Do you think about that? I mean, do you, as you're writing, do you give yourself the latitude to dip back into childhood? Or is that something that you don't need to do?
Yeah, because I'm still not I don't know what age I really am. So I guess it's not so hard for me to dip back, you know, and I, especially in while I'm writing, I can go back to any age at all.
Mm-hmm.
And when the first protagonist we meet, Crystal, when Crystal begins to wonder about these things, it's much the same way I wonder about these things. And she is trying to protect her daughter in much the way I've tried to protect my daughters. And sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't. And sometimes they will do what they're going to do. You cannot stop that from happening. You can only hope that their training is going to pull them out of whatever trouble they get in, you know? And Kismet does get into some big, big trouble. It has to happen. This is a novel. And it has to happen. And she has to have, you know, I told you it was, I said something about it being a love triangle. There are these two guys, and one of them is maybe one of my favorite characters. He was one of the first characters I wrote. His name is Hugo, and he is a homeschooled roan giant, and he's a reader, and he is sort of got the heart of a 9-year-old girl and the physicality of a linebacker who hasn't really ever trained to be a football player.
You refer to Hugo as a gentle giant.
Yes, he is a gentle giant.
And is in this triangle along with a farmer by the name of Gary Geist. What is it like to have that sort of triangle, especially when you have such affection for one of those characters?
You know, by the time this was over, I had affection for all of them. And and the affection for Gary really surprised me because he was not the person I would expect to feel any sort of tenderness toward, but I really did. And of course, this is what happens. Once you start to write a character, you begin to develop a relationship with that person, that character. And then it's very hard not to have compassion for the things they do.
We were talking about Kismet Poe is the character's name. Kismet is a lapsed goth. How would you describe that?
Lapsed goth still has bits of black lacquer on her nails. Still puts a lot of eyeliner on, but has forgotten to dye her hair black. It hasn't really an idea of whether this is a philosophy or a look. So is very alone. Nobody wants to, there isn't sort of a community for her, except for Hugo thinks she's the coolest person in the world, but there isn't really this is a small town, and her way of expressing her gothiness is to wear edgy clothing. And I don't really even talk about the music she listens to or any of the other things that she does, but it's a deranged thing for her to decide to go, and this tells you a little bit about her, to decide to really turn her life way over and marry a very, in his own way of thinking and his own outlook, a very normal type of guy, an heir to a very large farm, and the high school quarterback, which tells you a lot about him mm-hmm. as a person, maybe, and also as a person who's, you know, I really enjoyed writing Gary because of his position on the team and his friendships on the team, he's a little bit protected by them the way they would protect him. They, you know, that's kind of an instinct to be protective toward Gary. At the same time, they kind of resent him.
Gary's interesting because with what he has going for him and an inheritance coming and desperate to marry Kismet, but deep down is just terrified, right? Is very unnerved.
Totally unnerved. And that's the thing, from the beginning, you know, something has happened. And it's really slowly revealed what happened, why he's so terrified, why his best friend Eric is trying. I loved writing Eric because he's a loyal best friend, a good person. You know, he's studying to be an emergency medical technician. He is an Eagle Scout. You know, he's just a good guy, always prepared. And he is very worried about his best friend. But Gary isn't worried about him. Nobody's worried about Eric, but Eric worries about everybody else in the book. I liked having a character like that.
And that's ultimately you, right? As the author of caring about everybody else.
Joe, I have to be that person. I mean, you can't write a book without having some deep identification with each character in the book. There's almost no one who didn't have a daily reality for me. And it's hard to let that go. I'm talking about this. It's hard to even talk about it for a while after you've stopped writing a book. Going out and talking about it, it almost feels a little transgressive. It certainly feels as though I may not be able to see everything clearly, but it's just how it is for a writer. You can't finish a book in which you haven't thought through a character's mistakes. You know, you have to think their mistakes through.
When you say you're still working, when you're out and you're talking about it and still coming to understand it, you have to fully understand it at the time, but then to understand what it means to the audience and to the wider world.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I have an interior relationship and understanding with the characters, but I have to step back and put them into some sort of configuration that will make sense to other people. Even though I've already written them down, I still don't really know how they are as characters is what you read about, but how I talk about them is very different from how I would write about them, because I didn't know any of this writing them down, right? I was finding things out every day. I would find out a little more, or you know, the way I write is I wander around and I usually try to keep an index card or something around so I can write on it. I will think about a line, or I will think about, oh, this is why they did that, or this is something they'd say, so there's all sorts of long-term relationships. I mean, and that it's a very different relationship than the relationship you have with family or friends, because you aren't going around thinking, oh, I know this is exactly what they would say in this situation. You get really excited. You don't write that down. You think, oh, she's going to be wearing this or that, you know, like she's going to be wearing this particular thrift store dress. And you really get it written down with a lot of detail. But you don't think that about friends and family.
Right. These are all characters who are very, they're very strong. They're very durable. They certainly may have their insecurities, but their stature is large, isn't it?
They are durable. I like that you use that word. You know, they are people who they've weathered a lot by the time we see most of the, you know, the people who are adults. They've weathered quite a lot. And everybody comes through life acquiring some damage and repairing it as best one can and going on. And, you know, you have to do those things. And I think that's what's so interesting is finding out what the damage is. At first, I will, you know, in first writing someone, for instance, Gary's mother, I had no idea why she was the way she was. And then I started thinking about the 1980s farm crisis and told me a lot about the way she is. So you don't know what's in a person when you first start thinking of them. And then as you go along, they start sometimes doing something as you're writing. It's almost as though somebody else grabs your pen and starts telling you something you just don't know about the character. And then you keep going, or they do something that's out of character, but you realize I'm going to write the character to this behavior, whatever it is.
And it shows us, or certainly in my reading of as a reader of what we're capable of enduring.
Oh, well, that's I guess what I would ideally like a person who's reading the book to feel or understand.
And the complexity of that. I mean, obviously, of how hard that is, because there's a lot of complications. There's a lot of contradiction. There's a lot of flaws, but there's a lot of decent moments and lovely and hopeful moments.
Yeah. That's something that I think is important. I think that's why it's important to read novels. It's because I think we get a very black and white view of what people are a lot of the time. And it's really important to get in to encounter another consciousness who is contradictory. So to experience from inside a person's thoughts, how one doesn't always think in a straight line, almost maybe ever. One doesn't always see things at first. And being able to go through life and understand that people can be contradictory, people can change, people can do something that doesn't define them the next day. You know, so this is why I think novels are a great way to understand people in that kind of non-compliant way, or that people are just not who you may think they are at first.
As we close, tell me about the title. It's a beautiful title, and it seems to have several meanings, and I'm curious as to how you thought of it.
Well, I grew up along the Red River, and as you do when you grow up near some feature of your land, your landscape, your childhood, I took it for granted, and it was always the river. Don't go in the river. Don't, or let's go fishing in the river. You know, it was always there, and it was always flooding. And every spring there would be a big question mark, like, would the flood come up to the doorstep? What would it cover? You know, there was always this question, how bad the flood would be. And there's a river that's truly contradictory. In the spring, it floods because it flows north, and it's always frozen at the northern end. And it's melting before it's thawed as it goes along. So it's flooding It's what makes the land so rich. And by summer, it really, I've seen it such a small trickle, you can just wade across it. So it is mighty. And I always think of it because the most dramatic part of that river is the surging flood of that river. It's also not mighty. It's also small. And we see it in every iteration during this book.
And those iterations are so beautiful with obviously the river, but of the characters and the relationship to one another. And it's such a beautiful novel in reading of something that is in a time that was harsh, and now even your last novel, which was more contemporary, but still is, times are still harsh, and yet we can have that hope.
Yeah. By the end, I think, I'm writing about a very supercharged, devastating landscape in some ways because using pesticides and herbicides and what that's bringing down. But I go into, by the end, solutions to things that have happened. And only, you know, only since 2008, so much has happened. So much is being discovered, developed. And I wanted to write about that too. So I wanted to write about hope too.
The new novel is The Mighty Red. It is published by Harper. What a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a delight to speak with you.
Oh, it's great to speak to you as well.
Louise Erdrich's new novel is The Mighty Red. It is published by Harper. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.